This is All In. I'm Miriam So. Today we're talking to some of the people behind the new season of Que Pasa Midwest, the bilingual podcast for Indiana's Hispanic community based out of WNIN in Evansville. We're joined now by Maria Thomas, Director of Digital Media at WNIN. Welcome, Maria.
Thank you.
You've been interacting with students about the podcast and some of the issues you cover. Can you talk about how that got started?
Yes. So for season six, we covered COVID, recovering from COVID. And we have a member on our community advisory board who works at one of the local universities, the University of Evansville, Erin Lewis. And she told us that there was a change maker class and the students were going to be coordinating with a local church to do a vaccine clinic after the mass. And so we coordinated with them to also attend this clinic and do interviews and find out why people decided to get vaccinated or not get vaccinated and how, you know, they felt about it. And since I personally am not fully bilingual, I actually partnered up with the students to translate for me. They were doing a project where they wanted to find out about healthcare in the community. And of course, we were talking about the importance of the vaccine and recovering from COVID. And so we wanted to just get people's views on that. So the students were amazing at translating. And one of them in particular was really great at actually coming up with her own follow-up questions based off the responses of the people we were talking to. So that was really an amazing experience that kind of started it all. That was Cindy Crow's class at the University of Evansville.
And so what kind of classes have you been talking to? Is it just students that were in Cindy's class?
No, so we've been talking to a couple of classes over the years, high schools and colleges. It's been Spanish classes, media classes, communication classes, business classes, things like that. And depending on what type of class we talk to, that just changes, you know, what aspect of the podcast we talk about. So with the Spanish classes, we usually talk about the mix of English and Spanish, since the podcast is bilingual and why we chose to make it that way. And then we talk a little bit about how we reach out to the communities and the importance of gaining the trust of people and making them feel comfortable before you start talking to them about really kind of personal things like the healthcare, which is why we decided to partner up with the students, because talking to someone about their healthcare and their views on healthcare it's kind of invasive. And mm-hmm. So I didn't want to add in a language barrier on top of that.
Well, and Sorry.
I was going to say for the business and communication classes, we just kind of talk about the process of making a podcast usually.
What has the overall response been like from students?
They've been amazing. They have a lot of questions usually, and they seem really interested in the podcast itself. We've had a few people interested in becoming interns for the podcast after they have done, we've done the presentations with their classes, and I'm looking forward to working with them next semester.
When you mentioned some of the students came up with their own follow-up questions, I was wondering, are these journalists in the making?
That's what I was thinking. She wasn't a journalism major, but I told her, I was like, hey, those follow-up questions are really good. Like, you're a natural. You should think about this.
Yeah. Well, was there a specific episode or topic that you've seen get a big reaction from students?
I think it would have been, we did two episodes from the vaccine clinic. And so, of course, those students were very invested in it. And then also we talked to a Spanish class, about the census episode, filling out the census. And they were really interested in it. It was about identity, really, because when you go to fill out the census, it wants to know, like, you know, your race and ethnicity. And for me, it wasn't too hard. I'm Black, so that was easy to mark for me. But then for Paula, it was a little difficult because she's Caribbean and she speaks Spanish, so she's Hispanic. And like her identity is like, it's hard to put it in a box, you know? Like, yeah. People aren't boxes. So we just talked about the complexity of identity, of being multicultural and things like that. And the students were really interested in them. And one of the students in the classes had the same issue. And we talked to them about the importance of filling out the census and, you know, had they done it before? Do they understand what it does for their communities? So that was a conversation we had recently, and that was really cool.
I can imagine that it's a roadblock to fill out the census if you can't find any representation on there. It makes you feel like, why bother?
Exactly. Yeah.
With regards to what you took away from listening to students? Is there something that you learned that surprised you or just something new?
Just they were curious. One of the things that has been big is source diversity. And so they were curious about how we find our sources. And a lot of times it starts with people you know, and then leaders in the community. And we've been working to diversify our sources so we're not going back to the same person over and over again. And so their questions just made me think more about that. And for this season, for season 7, John Auerbach and Steve Berger right now are in Nebraska. So like that's diversity in terms of states that we've been covering. They're currently working on an episode or two out there.
That's really cool. So it's expanding.
Yes.
Is there something about the podcast format you think is really effective for schools?
I think it is just the range of topics that get covered and the conversational nature of it. Yes, there are some serious topics that are covered, but we try to make everything relatable by having the story of a person who's gone through it. And we didn't want it to be too NPR, like, too reporty, I guess you could say. I'm using real great words for a communication specialist. but yeah, we just wanted it to be something that is easy to listen to. So it's pretty short. 15 minutes is about the max for an episode. And we just try to make sure that we have a nice mixture of facts and statistics along with the dialogue, the conversation with the people that we talk to.
When it comes to working on stories, I think journalists oftentimes get sort of isolated by working on something and then jumping to the next story, the next story. What is the value, do you think, or is there a value in doing this kind of a long-term engagement with the community?
Yes, I am so happy that we are at this point in time now where we are doing this community engagement because for me, when we go out and talk to these people, I feel connected to them, especially when you're talking about things that are so personal and, to them and just in general. And so now being able to partner with these classes and actually make a change for the people that we're talking to has been so amazing. And I'm really looking forward to seeing what we can do in the future. We've talked to another professor at the University of Evansville-Lorena, who is going to have a medical Spanish class. And after we did that vaccine clinic and saw the impact that it had, we were thinking about what more can we do? So the university has a clinic that they have that goes out into community, and we're thinking about how we can partner with the Spanish students in this clinic and just everything. There's a joint medical school in Evansville. So there's a lot to look forward to. And I really think that when you make media that can make change in the community, that's really something special.
Being able to bring people together and to provide information and resources is awesome. And how do you get to that level where you have been able to earn trust in the community that you're covering?
For us, having a native Spanish speaker was the number one thing. And then moving on from there, as I mentioned before, just really making connections with people that are trusted in the community. So in the case of the vaccine clinic, we talked to the priest of that church, and he made an announcement after church saying, "Hey, these people are here, the medical people are here to give you vaccines. I got my vaccine." He actually lost his dad to coronavirus. So for him, it was really important that he protect the people that, he's serving in his parish. And he also said, and on top of these people being here for the vaccine clinic, we have some students and our local NPR station here to talk to you about it. So having someone that they look up to and trust say, "Hey, these people are here and it's okay and you can trust them," really helped us out a lot. And he even came up after and helped us find people to talk to because it is scary when there's a microphone and all this equipment in your face. He's like, "Hey, these are my friends. Like, do you want to talk to them? Just answer a few questions." So things like that are really helpful.
Have you seen a change overall in the community's response to the work that you're doing?
I think more people are aware of it now. It's always been positive and has continued to be a positive response. But it's really cool to go out and they're like, "Oh, Gay Boss Midwest," to get to that point.
Yeah. Well, is there an overall focus for season seven of the podcast?
Yes, so season seven is taking a look at how rights are applied to citizens versus non-citizens with a specific focus on the Bill of Rights. And so we're going to be looking into a case. What John and Steve are doing is a case study in Nebraska based on two communities, and then or on a community, and then looking at the regional area. And then we have April Alonzo in Cicero, Illinois, who will be comparing two communities and the res who have a similar demographic makeup, and just kind of like the resources they have in each community, and how things have been different in certain cases.
Before we let you go, can you give us a quick few sentences or so about why it's important to have this kind of a resource, a bilingual podcast?
So representation is important, and that is such an understatement. And especially now, having or in the past two seasons in a pandemic, we saw how important it is to get information to people and not have barriers, not have a language barrier or a barrier of like media or whatever it is. So the thing about the podcast is that it is digital. It can reach people where they are on whatever device they're using on many different platforms. And then, of course, it is important to know your rights. So season seven, that's kind of a little bit of what we're looking at. And having them explain to you in your language is very important because once again, it's all about removing barriers and increasing understanding.
Thank you so much. Maria Thomas is the Director of Digital Media at WNIN in Evansville. We'll be back after a quick break. We're talking to some of the people behind the new season of KPASA Midwest, the bilingual podcast for Indiana's Hispanic community. If you have any questions or comments for the show, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're talking today about the new season of KPASA Midwest, the bilingual podcast for Indiana's Hispanic community based out of WNIN in Evansville. To dive deeper into one story being covered this season, we're joined live by two guests. Steve Berger is vice president of radio for WNIN in Evansville, and John Orbach is a reporting and production intern for the KPASA Midwest podcast. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Good to be here.
Steve, I'll start with you. What's your overall focus for this new season of the podcast? What do you want to cover?
Well, as Maria just mentioned, it's about the rights of Latinos and how well they're being applied in the Midwest. And we're going to do case studies on several topic areas. She mentioned one that our new collaborator, Cicero Independiente, talking about freedom of speech. And what we will do in all the episodes is at the end, we will explain the rights that would apply to the episode. So we'll be doing a case study in the case of the freedom of speech episode on two communities, Cicero and Berwyn, which are both suburbs of Chicago, and how their approaches to citizen speech and inquiry differ. And then at the end, we'll talk about what rights are involved. We're also going to have an overview with the constitutional expert. We also have some segments from our most popular past contributors, like Angela Gervasi, who will profile language access in healthcare, keying on a Trump administration policy that took away critical healthcare information in other languages during the pandemic. Now, the Biden administration has not restored it, but we're talking with a couple of attorneys who have sued the Biden administration, and now apparently that policy is being reversed. So we'll have some breaking news for listeners when that happens, although it probably will take several months before the information in other languages is available for healthcare. And then Angela is also going to be doing an episode on community healthcare for Latinos. And we have an episode on housing from Judith Ruiz Branch, who's also in Chicago. Judith is one of our best storytellers and investigators. I don't have a lot of specifics on her episode right now because they're just getting started, but we hired a data reporter to work with Judith on that very important housing episode. So I'm looking for a great episode from that. And then last but not least, John's in-depth look at Schuyler, Nebraska, which has become an example of how to handle the Latino influx well in many ways, but it's also a lightning rod for criticism from others who don't want to see more Latinos in the Midwest. So that's pretty much where we're at with season 7 right now. The episodes will start dropping the first week in November.
John, can you tell us about the story that you're working on in Nebraska and how that came together?
Sure. So I started looking at the town of Schuyler. I think it's a really interesting case because it experienced a lot of immigration really quickly. And it's a small town that didn't have too much infrastructure. And it really, the immigration really picked up really quickly in the 90s. So essentially, if I can go into the history, if that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what a lot of Latinos, to use a simplistic word, came to the Midwest, in I guess to Nebraska in separate waves. The most important one for this story was in the 80s and 90s. It started in the 80s and Schuyler is a meatpacking town. There's a big meatpacking plant called Cargill. And that is the biggest employer by far in Schuyler. And so in the 80s, in 1982, the plant closed because of economic troubles. That's what they said. And then 2 years later, it reopened. But the wage was $3.45 lower per hour. So a lot of the people who used to work there, white people, a lot of the white people left. And a lot of Latinos, again, simplistic word, came from Mexico, from the South, from Texas, from California, up to the Midwest to work in the plant. And so that started in the 80s, and then in the 90s, and in the early 2000s, it really boomed. So kind of looking at that and seeing how over time Latinos have become majority in Schuyler. Some estimates or the official data says it's 73%, but I've spoken with people who think it's 80 to 85%. So we wanted to look at how a town that's majority Latino, how it's working. And for the most part, as Steve said, it's going well, but there are definitely some places that could be better.
Well, what convinced you that this would be a story worth diving into?
Yeah, so I think the history of Schuyler is quite interesting because it was originally inhabited by German and Irish and Czech immigrants. And over time, they kind of grew into assimilation and it kind of became those were the people who were living there. And then in the 90s and in the 2000s, a lot of those people started leaving, but there was also a lot of discourse about the Latinos here are taking our jobs. They're taking, they're coming into our town, and that was something that piqued my interest because if you look at the state of Nebraska, and the latest census data. You'll see that 69 of the 93 counties in Nebraska are losing population. And Schuyler is one of those places that is actually growing in population. And I spoke to a few people there and I asked them what would happen if Latino immigration didn't come to Schuyler. And everyone said it would be a ghost town. It just wouldn't exist anymore. So I think the idea that people are coming and taking their jobs is not only not true. From what I've seen, it's actually the opposite. That's actually the reason you could still have a job there. And in addition to that, we just wanted to kind of see how Latinos' rights have been treated today, now that they are at such a high percentage and also lack a lot of the political representation that generally comes with being a majority of those numbers.
Steve, immigration can be quite a broad topic and complicated with so many different paths that you could take in reporting. What is the benefit of focusing on a single town like this one?
Schuyler, in many ways, is just the perfect case study for what has happened in the Midwest. because the Latino influx into the Midwest has primarily been because of agriculture, in the case of Schuyler, the meatpacking plant, or manufacturing, as in the case of some of the larger cities like Chicago. So focusing on Schuyler was, it seemed like the natural thing to do, because it's been documented by some other news organizations in the past. In fact, 60 Minutes was there in 2005 because of exploitation at the meatpacking plant. So the issues that Schuyler has dealt with over the years in dealing with the influx of Latinos to that area is just really a microcosm of what has happened in the rest of the Midwest. So that's why we chose Schuyler, and it did not disappoint us. It was quite an amazing place.
I'd like to learn more about that, what it was like to be there in Schuyler. And John, what was your first impression when you went there?
My first impression was, I loved it. It's when you go to the downtown, a lot of the businesses are in Spanish. I walked in, people say hola, you know, it's kind of the Spanish is kind of the lingua franca there. And that's something that I enjoyed. And that's not true of all parts of Schuyler. And there are definitely places where that would not be the case. But in the downtown specifically, there are all sorts of Mexican shops and Guatemalan shops. And I think it's important to note too that when I say Latinos in Schuyler, it's really not a monolith. There are people from Mexico, from Guatemala. There are indigenous people from Guatemala, and even within the indigenous communities in Guatemala, there are some indigenous languages that are not mutually intelligible. And there are also people from Peru and El Salvador, and increasingly there's a community from the Horn of Africa, from Somalia, Ethiopia, Sudan. And you can tell, I think it's there are a lot of, I mean, the best restaurants that I went to were Mexican. It's definitely not the kind of old retirement home area that it used to be, according to people I spoke to. It's really interesting, and it's small. It's a small place.
Steve, what about you? What was your experience there?
I came to Schuyler with a little different viewpoint than John, because he was most interested in the Latino side. I really was there to look at the white population, which was the majority and is now the minority, and also the leaders in the community. And I did some interviews with them and got to talk to them. And what was what we found is that Schuyler is actually a singular case, and perhaps not quite as indicative as we thought about the rest of the Midwest, because the conditions in Schuyler are very specific. That is that the meatpacking plant was the major employer. The white population worked at the meatpacking plant. The meatpacking plant closed and then reopened with a lower wage. So the whites decided they didn't want to work there anymore, and so they left. And what we've got people on record, both sides, Latinos and whites, saying is that if not for that, the progress and the success of Latino influx in Schuyler would not have been as prominent or as easy. Because if the white population had stayed there and the Latinos came in, there would have been more problems. And they were fairly honest. They were pretty open and honest about it. So the fact that they are a success story now is a very special case. So in that sense, it's not a particular case study for the rest of the Midwest, because obviously there are places where the economy is good and Latinos are coming in. So we're going to need to do some more work in subsequent seasons on some of that, in trying to really drill down and find out what's happening with Latino immigration into the Midwest.
John, would you say that primarily the folks that are in that town now are immigrants, or would you say they're first, second, third generation Americans now?
I think they're definitely both. from one of the characters around whom I think I'm going to make the narrative of the episode, one of the two, he said that the kind of the kind of course that a lot of people take is a lot of people come from wherever it is, Mexico, Texas, mostly California, and if they're first generations, if they're coming from another country and they don't speak English, they'll work in the plant on the line. But as time has gone on, a lot of people are having kids, they're having grandkids there. This is their home. This character I spoke to, Victor Lopez, who worked in the plant, came straight from a small town in Jalisco in Mexico. And he, as the years went by, he opened his own business. And now he told me, my grandkids are going to live here. This is my home. I have a home in Mexico, but it's my parents' home. This is my home. So I think we'll get more and more of that sort of sentiment of permanence in Nebraska and kind of a patriotism in that sense too, but not that detracts from the pride of coming from one's country. I think those two things act together.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. It's like having another legacy for future generations.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah.
Well, Steve, what do you think Skylar tells us about the current state of immigration in the Midwest? I know you said it's not exactly going to be the litmus test for the rest of the Midwest in Skylar, but what would you say overall it tells us?
Well, it shows us what's possible when local officials cooperate with the Latino influx. In this case, they had to because that was the only population that was there. But when you do work together, some amazing progress can be made. And that is ultimately the story of Skylar, Nebraska, or at least as it's being written right now, is that, yes, there are still problems. There are still issues, and we're going to talk about those. But it is also an example of what can happen when populations work together instead of trying to fight each other. Now, there is a little bit of a black cloud on the horizon. I visited an ESL class while I was there, and one of the director of the program actually told me that they're beginning to see more pushback now on continuing to help the immigrants. There are conservative groups in Nebraska that are beginning to push back, and that movement was pretty quiet for a number of years, but now it's beginning to reassert itself. So that's, again, we may have to go back out to Skylar at some point and see just how that is all playing out.
Are there any places in Indiana that are similar to Skylar?
Yeah. Thanks for that question. There are two areas that I'm aware of in Indiana: Du Bois County in southwest Indiana, Jasper, and also Elkhart County up around Elkhart, that have higher populations of Latinos. One agriculture in Du Bois County and manufacturing in Elkhart County, who have also worked successfully with Latino populations. But there, in those cases, it's from a position of growth. You know, the poultry industry in Du Bois County and the RV industry in Elkhart County. So there is definitely applications for Indiana.
Before we say goodbye, I want to ask you, John, what do you hope listeners will take away from this story when it comes out?
Yeah, I hope that listeners can. Well, I guess it depends on who listens, but I hope that the point comes across that Latinos in immigration can bring prosperity in many cases, and kind of the addition of other cultures. A lot of people are not anti-America or you know, it's kind of just I'm not really sure how to put it. I'm sorry. I kind of just hope that.
Yeah, we all want the same things, I think, basically, and highlights our humanity.
Exactly. Thank you.
Well, Thank you to both of you for taking the time today. Steve Berger is vice president of radio for WNIN in Evansville, and John Orbach is a reporting and production intern for the KPASA Midwest podcast. I'm Miriam Soeb. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. On the show today, we've been hearing from the people behind KPASA Midwest, a bilingual podcast for Indiana's Hispanic community based out of WNIN in Evansville. Now we'll learn about research being done on some of the topics we've talked about, coming from a group of students at the University of Evansville. And we're joined now by three guests. Cindy Crow is a professor at the University of Evansville, and we have two students from the university, Kimberly Zamora and Cynthia Spady. Cindy, you teach a medical Spanish class at the university. What do you cover in that class?
We basically start with vocabulary, anatomy, and also cover some of the cultural beliefs associated with the Latino community.
Is it common for schools to have a class dedicated to medical language?
Actually, I don't believe so. I think we may be the only school that offers a medical Spanish minor. And also a major with a concentration in medical Spanish, at least around in our area.
And how did it get started? Has it always been there at Evansville?
No, actually, I think it was 2013. And we decided that it would be a good idea, maybe, since we have such a wonderful health professions, nursing and PT and exercise science. So I went to the curriculum committee and we got approval to have a medical Spanish class. And then it grew from just one class into the bona fide minor. So we actually have two classes dedicated to medical Spanish. And then if you're majoring in Spanish with a concentration in medical Spanish, there are related classes that you take.
Kimberly, you're in the medical Spanish class, I understand. Why were you interested in it?
Well, personally, I was interested in it because I am an exercise science major and I am aspiring to be a physical therapist. I'm actually currently going through the application process for physical therapy schools. I also do come from a Spanish-speaking background. Both of my parents are immigrants. One is from Mexico and the other is from Colombia. So I grew up in a household that primarily speaks Spanish. I did not get the opportunity to learn Spanish as well as I had hoped as a child. So I took the opportunity to take these medical Spanish courses to hopefully help me in my future careers.
Have you found the classes to give you something new that you didn't know before?
Yes, definitely. I have learned so much about my own culture that I've never been able to experience at home or in my community, and I've definitely learned a lot from it.
Cynthia, you're working on data analysis for a project right now. What are you looking into?
Yes, so I'm part of one of UE's Change Lab courses. And in this course, we're focusing on interviewing members of the Hispanic community in Evansville about their perceived healthcare needs. So mainly our work has been going to COVID vaccination clinics at a local Catholic church after Spanish Mass. And there we serve as translators for any members of the Hispanic community who come to be vaccinated. And then we ask to interview them about their healthcare needs here in Evansville.
That's really cool. I mean, that sounds like such a rewarding experience to be able to go and translate and offer resources and help to folks.
It really is. It's a very special opportunity, and it's been very nice to meet a lot of different members from the Hispanic community here in town and to hear more about their lives and just who they are and what they need.
With regards to the data that you've been looking into, what has been the hardest part of the process from what you've experienced? Is it getting solid data or turning it into information that people can understand?
Right. So we've actually been doing this research for 2 years. This is our second year now. And I would say that the most difficult part this semester has been getting enough data. I think because where we mainly work and where we mainly interview people is at vaccination clinics. But this semester, I think so many members of the Hispanic community here have already been vaccinated that not as many people come to the clinics. And so we don't have as many opportunities to interview people. So collecting larger amounts of data has been difficult.
And when it comes to the data that you do want to gather, how do you figure out what type of data you want?
Well, people from our class have compiled a list of questions that we think pretty well covers many areas of healthcare needs, just questions about how comfortable people feel when they go to visit doctors, what the translation options for them are at those clinics, and as well as just asking them what kind of risks they experience in their workplace due to COVID and how COVID has impacted their living situation and how that in turn has impacted their health needs.
Cynthia mentioned the Change Lab. Can you explain to us what that is?
Yes, this is something that UE does for the community and for the student body. So basically, it's a semester-long course, and the students create positive change by working with businesses, nonprofits, community groups. The classes are guided by coaches, and those coaches can be from the business community or they can be actual UE faculty members. And the courses generally attract a multidisciplinary team of students who work with these stakeholders. And then we try to provide services, develop innovative solutions, and just in general, meet the needs of the stakeholder from the community.
How important is it to have this kind of work for students?
Oh, I think it's absolutely essential because this is a way that they can take what they learn and actually apply it at the time they are learning it and benefit that way, as well as getting experience where they can then put this on their resume and it will lead to good job opportunities for them. It's just a win-win situation. The community gains and the students also have this experience. And I just can't say enough good things about it or about the students that I have been privileged to work with through these. We're on our third semester now of the Change Lab that works with the local Latinx community health needs. So it's an amazing program that just helps everybody gain knowledge, gain responsibility, and become closer to the community and to others in general.
How does it compare to a traditional class that's confined to a classroom, being able to go out and actually be immersed?
Well, some of the classes that we offer in Spanish do offer service learning components, but generally the classes have to focus on more of a pedagogical approach that is limited in what they can do outside the classroom. So a lot of the focus is, if you're taking a literature class, you focus on literature. And if you're taking a beginning level or an intermediate level class, you focus on grammar. So to have this possibility, in addition to what you are learning from an academic standpoint, is really something special for the students.
Kimberly, what have you learned working on this data project? Are there any kinds of issues you've seen that need to be addressed?
Yes. So I think one of the main things that stood out to me when we were compiling data was the fact that a lot of the Hispanic community in Evansville has perceived their healthcare as somewhat cold compared to the healthcare that they received in their native countries. So I think that's something that really needs to be addressed, not just in Evansville, but everywhere, because I'm sure that this is a problem no matter where they are located. And I was very excited because we actually got the opportunity to express these concerns to current healthcare workers and the podcast that you had also mentioned. So hopefully this is something that will bring awareness to their perceived healthcare needs and hopefully bring more light to the fact that there needs to be a change.
Cynthia, are there any plans in place for what you'll do with this data and your analysis?
Yes. So our class is hoping to We are in the midst of creating a PowerPoint presentation that summarizes the data that we've analyzed, and we are hoping to present this data in several different locations. We know for sure that we are going to be able to present this PowerPoint to a UE nursing class. We are also hoping to go to a local OBGYN clinic and present the information there. And we are currently looking for other places where we can talk about what we found.
And is there any specific place you would love this information to get to at some point?
I think in general, just as many medical clinics as we can access and reach out to in Evansville. Not a specific location per se, but just as many locations as possible so that we can share with as many people as possible what we've found.
Cindy, what feedback have you gotten from students working on projects like this?
The feedback has been totally positive. I have heard nothing negative at all from the students. I am just totally amazed by what they are able to accomplish on their own. One of the things that we did in the spring last year was what the stakeholder had asked us to do, and that was to try to figure out why the Latino community were not getting vaccinated at the rate that they thought they should. And so the stakeholder asked if my students could possibly figure out some way to get word out so that there wouldn't be misunderstanding and misinformation about the vaccine. And I'll let Kimberly talk about this. She was the one that actually created this pamphlet that led to a discovery that I don't think anyone was too aware of, which then in turn led to the clinic that we did in the spring. So Kimberly, you want to talk about that?
Yes, of course. So towards the initial stages of our kind of conversation of what we were going to do with our change lab, Ascension St. Vincent Hospital reached out to us and asked us if we could create some sort of flyer or a pamphlet to further educate the Latino community about the importance of getting the COVID vaccine. So I decided that making the pamphlet was a project that I would really dedicate myself to, and I began doing some research. And with that research and with the input of some of my classmates and even advice from my parents, I settled on a myths versus facts type sheet where the misconceptions about the vaccine could be presented clearly and effectively. And I chose some of the most important highlights directly from the CDC website, and I translated them into Spanish onto the pamphlet. I also made sure to include some brief instructions about how to navigate the website where Indiana residents could schedule their vaccine appointments, since it was still pretty early on in terms of the distribution of the vaccine. And I included the address, phone number, and the website of the hospital. But I think one of the most important things that we discovered was information about whether or not a form of identification was required upon arrival to the appointment. And so we discussed with St. Vincent about their protocols, and they encouraged it, but it was not required. And this topic was discussed for a really long time because we realized that there may be undocumented individuals who are worried about having to present this identification to get their vaccine. And maybe that was the issue why they were reluctant to actually acquiring it.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing to discover. And I'm just thinking in general, I don't think you have to show ID for vaccines. So that's interesting that that would even have been an issue with the COVID-19 vaccine.
Yes, it was an issue at the time. And actually, after we looked at the pamphlet that Kimberly had created, and we saw how difficult it was for someone who did not speak English to be able to follow those directions and get to the vaccine clinic, and that it specifically said that that identification was required, then is when we reached out to St. Vincent, Ascension St. Vincent, and we worked with them, and the pharmacist in charge actually reached out to the state, and the state said, you can just ignore that. Let's just get everybody vaccinated. So then we reached out to a local Catholic church and decided that that's where we were going to hold a vaccination clinic, so that right after the mass in Spanish, we would have a captive audience, so to speak. And we got it all set up, and over 100 people, 100 Latinos were vaccinated on that one occasion that day.
That's got to feel remarkable, Kimberly, to be able to have created some positive change.
Oh, yes, definitely. I 100% went to my parents about it and explained how excited I was that I was able to be a part of that experience. Just because I understand the struggles of overcoming language barriers and like kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? Settling in a different country that's different from your own. So I was definitely very proud to be a part of that experience.
Cynthia, we're going to get ready to wrap up here. And I wanted to ask you and Kimberly both what your plans are after school. So Cynthia, what are you thinking to do when you're done with school?
Well, I'm a Spanish education major, so I am hoping to become a middle school or Spanish high school teacher full time. I'm actually working part time as a Spanish teacher right now in college. So that's a really great experience to practice for the future.
And Kimberly?
My plans are to pursue higher education at a physical therapy graduate school. I would love to be a physical therapist, and I would also love to get some more experience with personal training part-time.
Wonderful. And Cindy, what is next for this program? Is it going to continue every semester with new projects?
That is my hope. So this semester, we're hoping to, as Cynthia said, we're hoping to be able to present workshops on cultural sensitivity for the healthcare providers so that they will be more cognizant of the fact that their patients do not necessarily have the same cultural perspective, not to mention a different language. And then next semester, we can continue with this, but another organization in the community has reached out to us and asked that we also help them. So we are forming an additional partnership in which the students will be able to serve as tutors and mentors to help in an after-school program so that the Latino students can get some help with their English and the native English speakers can learn some Spanish and there'll be better communication all the way around with the parents as well. So we just keep working and see what we can do to help.
Well, thank you all so much for joining us. We really appreciate your time. Cindy Crow is a professor at the University of Evansville, and Kimberly Zamora and Cynthia Spady are students at the University of Evansville. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. I'm Miriam Sove. Thanks for listening. This is All In.